financial independence, country shopping, van nomadism, security culture, ethical enclaves, crypto anarchy, legal interstices, survivalism. Join your hosts, Shane and Kyle, as they explore this freedom strategy known as Vonage. You're listening to the Vonage Podcast.
And welcome to the Vonage Podcast, the podcast making you invulnerable to coercion. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm Shane and...
I'm K-Y-L-E, Kyle.
Wow. Okay. Well, I mean, you switch it up. I like that. So, Kyle, why don't you go ahead and bipcot this thing for us?
Since governments are the primary coercers upon individuals, the Vonage Podcast is covered by a bipcot no government license. Reuse and modification is permitted to anyone except for the governments and the agents thereof. You can learn more at bipcot.org.
Very good. And I'd also like to add, you know, just off the cuff here, you know, anarchist politicians, too. You can't do anything with our podcast. Anyways, very good. Very good. So we definitely hope you've had a great couple of weeks during the intermission between season one and season two. Yes, we are finally here and it's time to get into some action. Hopefully you found those interviews to be entertaining and valuable as we got our feet under us for this next installment of the podcast. So Kyle, man, this has probably been the longest we've gone without chatting since we first became acquaintances over, what's it been now, like over 2 years?
Yep.
Nonetheless, it's great to be back with you as always, man. What's new on your end?
Well, let's see. I've been working a combination of temp jobs and overtime and such. So I guess in some ways it's kind of appropriate to this particular episode or two or thereabouts. So yeah, that's kind of what I'm just exporting that labor. For those folks who remember that from season one. Just doing some exporting labor.
And let me ask you this: I mean, did you acquire those temp jobs specifically, for purposes of we'll say grammar work as part of season two and season three of the podcast, or just to assist you financially, or what was your reasoning?
it was more of a coincidence in some ways, but then once I was into it, I kind of was asking myself, does this really count as exporting labor? And I guess in some ways it did, in some ways it didn't, because of course reality doesn't necessarily or always correspond to theory. But it was definitely a very valuable learning experience at bare minimum, and I was very thankful to have the opportunity to do so, if nothing else than resume building.
Yes, definitely. So I'd like to provide an introduction to season two before we even get into the main topic of discussion. This season is titled The Practice of Vonage, which is focused upon section two of Rayo's book. Herein, we'll only examine and discuss what Rayo specifically mentioned in his book. We will obviously provide some sneak peeks in passing, but season three will be the time when we expand and adapt Vonage to today. But again, we are into the action now, so the philosophy is done. These are some things you can, put into practice today, or tomorrow, or hopefully today. But give you some time to prepare for those things. But to give you an idea of how much there really is to cover, we have 18 episodes on the schedule right now, and I'm sure that will end up being in the mid 20s range by the time it's all said and done. With Kyle, when we get to recording podcasts. Especially ones like this that we're, really passionate about. A lot of things come up, on the fly. And there's often times where we have to break things up into two-parters. So I can only imagine that 20 to 30 podcasts for this series. But in other words, this season will be much longer than season one. This specific episode is titled Financial Independence, the Utility of Import-Export, and the show notes can be found at vonagepodcast.com/14. So, Kyle, anything else to add before we dig into this this very first episode of season two?
Sure, and it's really kind of more just kind of reflecting the transition between season one and season two, which is mainly this: we are done with philosophizing. Okay, maybe argumentation ethics might come up every once in a while in transitory passing. But if you folks want more details about that or more details about what Rayo thought about the servile society, which will come up again this episode because this is about importing and exporting labor, but we're going to focus more on doing it practically, go back to season one. So this is the action portion. So we're going to be talking shop here and getting into details in terms of how to make Vanu work.
Yes, and again, season one was so that when we mention these things in passing, like we say, the mutualist cooperatives, we just kind of mention those and just move on because we've already covered those in season one. So if you're a first time listener, great to have you. But we definitely recommend checking out season one first. Or if you're kind of adept to anarchism and things of that nature, that's good. But Vanu is something just a little different, even though it overlaps some. So I'd recommend you go check out season one, or at the very least, all of Kyle's articles corresponding with that season are up on the website vanupodcast.com. Those will give you an insight into why we're discussing why Rayo discussed these things in his book and why he found them valuable. So there's a very good reason why we're launching this season off with financial independence. You have to have the money to spend first before you can spend it on your Vanu activities. That, and it's going to be quite difficult to focus on improving your capabilities, as Rayo said, and as we'll kind of get into here in a moment, while you're worrying about how you're going to pay for your food next week. Being financially independent is definitely important and a good start.
Well, yeah, of course. And not only that, but in some ways it sets the stage for other types of ways of pursuing venuance. This is pretty much, kind of the interesting question about, kind of kicking off season two here and getting into the nuts and bolts, as it were, is whether people, and we'll get into this in future episodes of season two, but whether it's like the van nomadism or the country shopping, some of these techniques does require some degree of capital accumulation. And so this episode is more focusing on, the capital accumulation that then opens the door so then you can, go live in a van or some of the other techniques that were also that are going to be part of season two here. So in a lot of ways, financial independence opens the door so that you can fund yourself as you pursue other forms of venuance. But also keep in mind that financial independence itself is a form of venuance in terms of improving your capabilities and becoming gradually more invulnerable to coercion.
Yes, definitely. So as always, let's begin with some definitions here to lay the framework for our discussion today. So Kyle, since you're in that position in this episode, what is financial independence?
Well, since I'm the definition man this go around, financial independence is defined as making a livelihood without a steady employer.
What about freelancing?
Freelancing could be defined as a form of financial independence whereby you are working for a variety of clients on a per assignment basis. So just to kind of go a little bit into this a little bit more, you don't have a steady employer, but you kind of have like a rotating or body of clients, or at least a sufficient new body of clientele that can basically keep you afloat financially.
Yes. And I'm sure some of you guys are familiar with stuff like freelancer.org, where, it's all about freelancing. Freelancing, maybe not in Rayo's day, but especially today, freelancing is a pretty common thing. I think the entire journalism industry, or at least most of it, is kind of done in that way. But what is intensive saving?
Intensive saving could be defined as yet another form of financial independence whereby, or perhaps a form of frugality, whereby you save anywhere between 50 to 80% of your take-home pay.
Yes, those things kind of do go hand in hand, right? Because you can't intensively save spending a lot of money, right?
Well, let me put it this way. I think it would be fair to conceive of freelancing and intensive saving where they could be mutually exclusive. However, if you were to combine them, it becomes one of a combined tool for achieving financial independence a lot sooner. So just to kind of extrapolate.
And you mean intensive saving and frugality.
Well, intensive saving and freelancing even.
Okay, yeah, okay, fair enough. Just okay.
So obviously we're going to try and stick to definitions. Let me extrapolate just a little bit here just to kind of make this simple. So you could just freelance and just do that and not intensively save for whatever reason, or you could work, you know, a 9-to-5 just over broke, a job with a steady employer. But yet be saving 50-80% of your take home pay, and that would be just your way to financial independence in that sense. And so you're kind of like counting down the days until you can quit, right? And still, you know, live off your capital accumulations. Or you do both. You become a freelancer, work for the variety of clients, and then whatever your take home pay is, you save 50-80% of that.
Yeah,
so it's kind of like you have like these three different approaches.
Yeah, and I think with freelancing too, and we'll move on here in a second, folks. But especially with the freelancing too, like rather than like if you're freelancing yourself and you kind of, you know, you have a website or something and people like your name's gotten around, you have a good, you know, you have good clients and new ones coming in. I mean, it's freelancing. You can decline jobs whenever you want to. So you could, like, I guess theoretically or hypothetically, you could, you know, work really, really hard for a few months, save up some money, and then or you know, do that for a year or two, get a nest egg, which we'll get more into here in a moment. And then essentially when you're trying to prepare your Vanu home and, you know, get some of those skills, you know, to you know, become more invulnerable to coercion, you can just decline jobs. And then, you know, once you need to go back to work, essentially, you can always, you know, rekindle that clientele, or, you know, hopefully you'll be well enough off that you can, you know, gather up new clientele pretty quickly. So, yeah, that is kind of an interesting aspect there. You know, I hadn't really thought about freelancing, you know, to that extent. But we have one more definition here. And I mentioned it. What is a nest egg?
A nest egg could be defined, or nest eggs in the plural, could be defined as batches of accumulated capital that were saved. So let me put it this way. So the end product of, to keep this as simple as possible, the end product of intensive saving would be the creation of nest eggs. So essentially, through that form of frugality, whereby you're saving 50-80% of your take-home pay, you now have what you didn't have before, these batches of accumulated capital that then you can use for whatever.
And, you know, as in season one, we're going to do this in season two as well. What Rayo said, we won't do this in season three, but obviously that'll still kind of come up here and there. But what did Rayo say about financial independence? First off, quote, freedom through wealth. Some have said that the best way to achieve personal freedom is to first become wealthy. Here are some contrary points. Someone pursuing wealth tends to get caught up in associated status games and neglect his real objective. Psychological paralysis sets in. Of freedom seekers I have known who tried to get rich, most have not been successful, perhaps because they knew too much to play the games with the same dedication and intensity as do the middle American strivers. The few wealthy libertarians of who I know first became wealthy, then libertarian. One is more apt to be successful and perhaps even get rich doing something he enjoys doing, which he can do without contradicting his values, than he is doing supposedly high-income activities, which he doesn't enjoy, end quote. So, Kyle, what do you think about what Ray had to say there?
I think right there he's criticizing consumerism, actually. Notice when he said about associated status games. That's consumerism, and for those people who may not know, especially if they haven't yet listened to the season one episodes, I have always said consumerism is anti-free market. So yeah, it's just kind of interesting here that Rayo is also essentially saying that, and I you know what, actually this passage reminds me of is Doug Casey. Actually, you know, the few wealthy libertarians of who I know first became wealthy, then libertarian. I mean, that sounds like Doug Casey to a T, and maybe even some other people. But I think Doug Casey being probably the poster boy.
Yeah. Yeah, that's yeah, it's definitely interesting. Definitely interesting. And I think he is right. I think he is right because I know, you know, as I came to libertarianism and never been rich, obviously. But even so, like, you know. I mean, yeah, there are, you know, like, let's say, you know, post office jobs, like it's like $18 or $19 an hour. And I know what they do every day. I see them, you know, driving through my neighborhood. Seems like pretty easy work. You can make some pretty good money. Obviously not rich, but, you know, compared to where I am, that'd be pretty decent. But still, I look at that job and it's like, no. How is that person being paid by stolen funds? I'm not going to do it. So he was definitely right then, and he's definitely, you know, describing me, and I would say you as well. When you kind of look at those jobs, you know, that contradict your values. So yeah, I think he's definitely correct there. That, you know, wealthy first, then, you know, libertarian or anarchist after.
Yeah, and notice that the folks who are, you know, in line with the private property ethic, a lot of times have to turn down or even just avoid even applying for certain forms of work that necessarily requires them to violate their conscience or violate the NAP, for example. So you're not going to see a lot of actual real, for example, libertarians, or as the case here, Vanuans, you know, becoming police officers, for example, okay, even if they pay well. Because the nature of their work is inherently unethical, period, just right out of the gate. I mean, would Rayo necessarily recommend that some people export their labor by becoming bludgies themselves?
No.
So, as you can kind of see, it's not just the problem, the oxymoron of what was mentioned in season one with things like anarchist politicians. There's also the issue, which is more relevant here, about people who claim to value freedom, people who claim to value liberty or some versions thereof, and essentially becoming the so-called anarchist government agents. I mean, this is kind of almost getting into constitutional sheriff territory,
or even,
you know, the anti government agents,
or even more so. I mean, yeah, this is kind of a blurred line around like fascism, but like a private company, like let's say, so like an individual could make, you know, really, really good money working for Raytheon or something. Like, it is a private corporation, right? And obviously the whole fascistic aspect of it, as I mentioned, but again, as Rayo kind of mentioned here, I mean, they a libertarian who's anti-war, or a Vanuan who's, you know, anti-war, wouldn't, you know, be too optimistic and, you know, driven to perform well at that job. And I think that's what Ray was kind of pointing out here, is that, someone who actually believes in the military industrial complex, who's very patriotic and very militaristic, they're going to, you know, be just nipping at the heels to, you know, get rise up in the corporation, and, you know, maybe into government as well. So I think he's definitely right about that.
Bomb it and pave it, and they'll enjoy doing it, as opposed to, shall we say, the controlled schizophrenic. See episode by same name in season one. The controlled schizophrenic who keeps his rationality compartmented instead of rationally looking at his life as a whole. To paraphrase Rayo. So I think that's kind of what's also being kind of implied here, is that if you do get an ethical backbone, but you weren't wealthy, so let's say you had the ideological conversion before you became wealthy, well, you're going to have a harder time, because when you actually look around the available job market, what you start seeing a lot, as I have, is that quite all too many of the jobs within the servile society. Again, see episode of the same name of Servile Society in season one. Too many of the jobs available in the Servile Society are actually quite unethical. I mean, I'm sorry, when was the last time a child protective services bureaucrat was an ethical line of work? Honestly. So, and it's not necessarily like government jobs and all that, because it, like you mentioned before, there's also kind of the fascist angle, which in many ways is almost impossible to avoid. You know, it's almost like becoming like almost like a version on a theme of like the 7 degrees of Kevin Bacon, in the sense of the 7 degrees of how can, let's say, a corporation not have government contracts. So you may not work for the government directly in terms of being like a bureaucrat or a cop or a soldier or a judge or things, you know, actual government agents, but you might work for a corporation that has contracts with a government agency, like an administrative agency, that fourth branch and such. And so that kind of, and then, or worse, what if that corporation who has the government contract contracted out to a different company, maybe a smaller company, and you work for that company, but ultimately, you know, the only reason for that work is because the government, you know, is hiring you for it through this intermediary. So they're kind of, without getting too much into double guessing, there is the admittedly tougher issue of how do you avoid working for fascists? I would just simply say this. Is it really too much to ask to, like, not work for socialists directly? Like, not actually being a government agent? Because I would like to think that's actually realistically achievable. It, to be fair, Shane, it may not be realistically achievable to avoid working for fascists. However, I do think it is realistic and ethical to avoid working for socialists and government entities directly. I do think that's at least achievable in this lifetime under current conditions.
Yes, yes, I would definitely say so. On to the next quote by Rayo here. Quote, "At present, there is relatively little Vanu to be purchased. It's mostly do-it-yourself. Most high-income professions are narrowly specialized, dependent upon an economy of tens of millions of people, but only a relatively few people, thousands at most, are apt to Vanu themselves in the foreseeable future. The demand in a small market is for broad skills. Most of the relatively free people in North America today have relatively low incomes. Hippies, hobos, some Indians, some blacks. Historically, Jews have been more successful than gypsies at surviving and maintaining heterodox cultures despite their greater emphasis on wealth. For what it's worth, gypsies have enjoyed better public relations," end quote. So I guess there the only point is, and I think this was still kind of ring true today, is, you know, you're gonna have to develop a lot of these skills yourself. I mean, you aren't gonna be able to to contract these out. I mean, you can't like, let's say you're building your Vanu home base, or you're putting together your Vanu home base. You can't really hire like Brinks to come do your security. Like, that's just not, like, you'll have to figure that stuff out on your own, right? So yeah, broad skills, you know, for that other Vanuans would need, is kind of what he's getting at here, I think. What do you think, Kyle?
I think it's rather significant and imperative to point out that when Rayo mentioned about most high income professions are narrowly specialized, think about licensure of certain usually white collar professions, doctors, lawyers, hell, even stockbrokers. Any profession that has like a arguably like a six figure salary or even more, a lot of times will be overly regulated. And so, you know, it's not just, you know, so yes, it's not just the so-called white-collar work. Going a little bit into agorist class theory here, it would also be very white market, where it's taxed and regulated and such, and you basically have no freedom. But the trade-off for the people who basically become indentured serfs to the system is that and very more, much more part of the servile society, even more ways than people who work minimum wage, at least in some sense, is that they have to bow and scrape and obey, because if they don't, you're fired. And that's how they control people. And the worst part is that then these doctors and lawyers and other white collar stockbrokers and whomever else, even like high powered like CEO corporate types or upper management of certain corporations, sometimes Fortune 500, sometimes not, but let's say six figure salaries, okay, they wear suits. Regardless of the specific type of work they do, or industry, I should say. I mean, these guys actually do not have a lot of freedom, but the trade-off for that is that they're just earning more ferns than you and I do. And they've made that choice, whether consciously or, as I suspect the case is more often than not, unconsciously. So people wonder, without getting too much into the servile society again, just in transitory passing, in some ways, it almost makes sense why the servile society is the way it is. It's because people made certain choices where they valued wealth over their own freedom.
Yes, yes, that's definitely a good way of putting it. Definitely. Okay, let's move forward to this this next quote by Rayo here. Quote, "Personal experience. I have only moderate savings. I'm not wealthy by most standards. But my achievement of Vanu has been limited much more by time and personal skills than by money. There are many products and services which I could and would purchase if they were available. They aren't. Of course, someone already into a skill or business whereby they can earn much money easily may well be advised to keep at it for a few years and build a nest egg. But for most Vanuists, I don't think wealth is much worth the effort." End quote. So, I mean, kind of ringing the same thing there, right? I mean, what do you think about that, Kyle?
I would slightly disagree with Rayo about it. I do think some degree of wealth is worth some degree of effort, but again, this is getting into the trade-off issue. Part of me thinks it's getting down to personal choice and, you know, how much wealth relative to how much freedom, at least in some sense. But, you know, even then I hesitate to say that because it's not the choice is not always necessarily that, because sometimes that dichotomy is true for some individuals, but I don't think it's universal. You know, for some people, they really do need some degree of money in order to have more freedom. I mean, look at a lot of the decentralized peer-to-peer economy digital technologies that have been coming out.
Let me step in here real quick as well, because I think my situation is unique and so much as I would need a bigger nest egg because I still need to buy my type 1 diabetes supplies. And thankfully to the pharmaceutical industrial complex, Big Pharma. It's quite expensive. So for me, like, it might even take maybe even more than a few years, like, for me to feel, secure, because I can't have freedom if I'm dead, right?
Yeah, there's that. So there's your medical situation and so forth. I would just simply say this. If you have people who are trying to pragmatically actually export their labor and do it in a way where they become the newer and such, given the opportunities that are currently available, the general trend entrepreneurially is going towards the decentralized peer-to-peer mm-hmm. economy that's usually largely digital. However, there is a catch. The catch is not only do you have to be familiar with those technologies, which many millennials are, such as you and I, and okay, that's not as much of an issue. What I've been coming across personally is that you have to have some degree of accumulated capital in order to afford said technologies if you didn't already have it before. Now, if you already had it before, then it's more an issue of just getting your butt to work and all that. Here, let me give you one example and make this concrete. Uber. With Uber, you have to have not just the smartphone, so there's your one capital, accumulated capital, if you will, expressed in that form, but you also need a car of a certain minimum model year, correct?
Mm-hmm, correct. Yeah, you're talking about drivers, yeah.
Well, that's how you would make, that's how you would export your labor in a sense, right? And then it's arguably a form of freelancing, right? Because you're actually being paid not by Uber, you're being paid by the passengers and such, the actual clients or customers. Okay, well, in order to do that, then, you need to have a car. And thankfully, there's been different options available to try and lower that barrier to entry even further, which I think is at least a good experiment. I don't know how feasible it is practically. That would require experimentation by entrepreneurs. I'm just simply saying, not counting some of the hiring services that some people are doing, initially you would need to have that car and you would either need to own it, you would either need to start making car payments and pay interest to bankers or whomever else, or you would have to own it outright, which you may or may not have before, or as some people did, they would actually have to borrow cars from people they knew personally in order to even work for Uber, which can get dicey, especially if you get into an accident. So again, there's different trade-offs here. And again, it's not my intention here to be a negative Nancy. My intention here is to look at this practically and realistically and try to gauge what the trade-offs are here and so forth. Now, again, that's about the decentralized peer-to-peer economy. Not all forms of freelancing or financial independence more broadly has anything to do with digital technology. I'm just using that as an example.
Yeah, and I think that's definitely a good point. That's definitely a good point. And I guess the point I want to make here, and this is something I kind of introduced the show with, is it'll make it a lot easier. And we'll get to a quote here by Rayo in a moment. But once you just imagine, something a little, where there's a lot more information on it. Like, let's just say homesteading, Kyle. Okay, homesteading or off-grid living, either one.
Yeah.
So you got to learn all that stuff. Like, it takes a lot of time to learn all of that. Like, if you have a garden, you've got to learn about all of that. You've got to,
right,
keep it managed, all that good stuff. You've got animals, like that, it just adds another thing to the equation. A lot of time, right? I mean, you're going to have less time to, like, go out and get a job go out and make money. The same thing is true here with Vanu as well. So I do think there is something to be said. If you have a decent job and you can, you know, like if you plan things out and you've got goals and you're going to achieve those goals, you know, okay, so 6 months I'll have this much money saved up, a year I'll have this much money saved up, this year I'll start looking into whatever, and then that 2 year mark hits, I'm quitting and I'm going to do whatever. I'm going to work on becoming invulnerable to coercion. I think there is something to be said for that, you know, building that nest egg.
Yes.
You know, whether it takes a year, 2 years, I mean, we're all individuals, right? And we've got different, you know, needs and preferences. And you know, we're all different insofar as, you know, some of us are more risk adverse and some are not. So there are a lot of, there are a lot of factors here. So for some, I mean, there could be someone who just, you know, decides tomorrow, I'm just going to, you know, take the leap, see what happens. But that's not for everyone.
Right, of course. And interesting you bring up the off-grid living thing. Let me just mention something kind of at least in passing. Obviously, folks, there's going to be a future episode specifically about buying land privately, quote unquote, if you will, because Rayo had some things to say about that. What I will say here in transitory passing just very briefly is this. Even for those of you who are either considering or have tried or on your way towards living off grid or somewhere along that spectrum, one thing I've kind of have learned from people who are actually doing it, that in some ways the kind of the upfront cost of even just buying the land, never mind building structures, whether it be a one room cabin, you know, ALA, Henry Thoreau's Walden, and so forth. It's not even so much that stuff. It's actually like getting like the actual land. And so forth. And again, not even so much the property taxes, just getting the land just outright, is kind of an upfront expense. And so if that is indeed the case, and the question is, okay, how are you going to pay for the land that's basically going to become your bug out location? See, so there's very much a cart before the horse situation here. That's why the inaugural episode for season two here is about financial independence, is we're trying to avoid the cart before the horse problem by trying to figure out how do you pay for all this stuff.
Indeed. I'm glad you brought that up again. Yes, yes. Very good. Let's some of these things will become more clear as we hear what Rayo had to say. But this next one, quote, "A Vanu home seems essential for psychological well-being, and domestic activities are relatively easy to Vanu. They do not require elaborate equipment or deep involvement with outsiders. In contrast, earning money takes up only a relatively small part of one's life." I'll stop here and add a note. Keep in mind this, I don't remember, the 60s or 70s was when this article was written. So when you hear these figures, you'll, you know, laugh at them, but just keep that in mind, you know, inflation, all that good stuff. Back to it, quote, "At $2 per hour clear, 300 hours of city labor with 1 month overtime will pay for 8 months of Vanu living, and earning money usually requires export, difficult to accomplish without interference. So Vanu should begin at home. While it's nice for a Vanu home to be financially productive, this isn't essential," end quote. Now, I guess the first point here that I would make is, you know, it would be having a Vanu home that is productive, you know, especially with the advent of the internet and all that good stuff. You know, I think that, like, not essential, but I think it'd be kind of a no-brainer, right? You know, if you could, even if it's just like a blog or a blog, vlog or whatever, and you can get some donations or a little bit of AdSense from it or something. I don't know. We'll discuss the Vanu aspect of those things later on, but just go with me here. I mean, if you can, you know, get a little extra side income from that, I mean, I think that's, you know, kind of a no-brainer, right?
Yeah, and regarding this particular passage, I think we need to kind of unpack this a little bit, because I personally, there's some stuff I agree with, some stuff I disagree with, and I think the differences are important. So let me start off on the positive end. I do agree with Rayo that import is a lot easier than export, because I think that, look at that, let's read that one part again. So the domestic activities are relatively easy to Vanu. They do not require elaborate equipment or deep involvement with outsiders. And I would say, at least to some degree, sure, the import is a lot easier than export because you have more control over that. Right. It's pretty much you go and buy things or whatever. You're importing goods and knowledge into your Vanu shelter and not forth.
Deep and balmy. You weren't trying to, you weren't like engaging with somebody to try to sell them something. You're just going in, and I mean, you can go into a store and talk to nobody and just get your stuff and get out of there paying cash, and there's no issues. So that's right. I mean, yeah, and when you're trying to sell something like a farmer's market or something, you're after, get involved with people, at least to show the value in the product that you're selling. So yeah, I just wanted to clarify that. Go ahead.
Sure. And so exporting labor requires, well, more effort, at least in some sense. And so, yeah, to that degree and in that context, I would agree with Rayo, at least in part, if not fully. Now, but then that next sentence where he says, in contrast, earning money takes up only a relatively small part of one's life. Yeah, I'm just going to go ahead and disagree here. I think the situation would be more like the other way around. Spending money takes up only a relatively small part of one's life. Earning money is a completely different kettle of fish, because for some people, yes, that would be true if they're already financially independent and they're living off of their investment dividends that they've painstakingly well invested in. Then yes, if they can basically pay their bills using their investment dividends, then yes, for them, well, their money is working for them, right? Instead of them working for their money. But they actually had to like work from the ground up and build all of that, which depending on what your savings rate is, could take about a decade or so. Different people for different situations, depends how frugal you're being and so forth, right? The guy who is living in a McMansion is going to take a lot longer to become financially independent than, say, somebody who's living in a crappy one-bedroom studio apartment on average. I mean, this is just the reality of the situation as it is. There's no theory here involved. These are just facts and like math and such.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I would agree. Like, if you look at it, you know, mathematically, 168 hours in a week, 40 hours, a week in work. And then, you know, overtime, if that's, you know, a requirement or if you have that option. So that's about a fourth of your time during the week, and then factor in, you know, sleeping. 8 hours, that's another 40. Yeah. So you're half of your life is spent working and sleeping.
Actually, I would slightly disagree with you about the sleeping part, but let me add another part. Commuting, actually, for people. And now, to be fair, Rayo, I think elsewhere mentioned about how you could arguably reduce commuting if you were to, like, let's say, live at the job site, which is actually legitimately, I think it's a good idea, at least in a possibility. And in that sense, a good idea, not available for everyone. But I think, you know, there's ways of trying to cut down on the commuting costs. Actually, hold on. I just thought of one other thing right off the top of my head. There's people I knew, I guess you could say, in not quite a past life for all the reincarnation aficionados, but let's just say over a decade ago when I was a much younger man, like before college, actually, where there were people I know who, instead of driving cars, they would ride motorcycles. And therefore, their gas bill would be a lot lower, even though they used to travel, were actually traveling the same distance. So there's different ways that could be used to try and, you know, get some costs down, at least in one sense or another. There's one other thing, too, I want to mention. Speaking about mathematics, obviously, there's the issue about the rate of inflation, right? So what I was able to calculate out, and this is in the article that goes along with this episode.
Again, VanuPodcast.com/14. Go ahead. Sorry, Kyle.
Yes, of course. The annual inflation percentage rate that I was able to find between 1972 and 2017 was about 4.1%. So 4.01%. Now, if I'm doing my math right, and if folks want to double check me on this, I would encourage them to do so. And if you hate my math, my email is kyle@vanupodcast.com. Basically, the math that I calculated out here from the 4.01% annual inflation percentage rate between 72 and 2017 was that the $2 in 1972 that Rayo mentioned, the 300 hours of city labor, as it were, that $2 in 1972 would be equivalent to about $11.75 today. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, Shane, but isn't minimum wage, like, what is it now? What the federal government said, what, $7.50?
Well, I mean, I don't know what the federal minimum wage, like, it's anywhere. I heard, like, it's like $8.25 is what I heard last time for the federal minimum wage. And then obviously like cities, I think Seattle went up to like whatever $15 an hour, whatever it is. But I think the federal minimum wage is like $8.25 or something along those lines.
Well, the reason I ask is because, and I don't want to get too much into the legal. Well, actually, not an interstice; it's actually just lawfare. But yeah, the Texas minimum wage is actually directly tied to the federal minimum wage, which is why I ask, because I honestly just don't know anymore. But yeah, whether it's $7.50 or $8.20 or whatever the minimum wage is, obviously $11.75 is above minimum wage, but not by much. So that is kind of something to consider, that assuming I did my math right here, Rayo is essentially kind of implying, and yes, I am kind of inferring here, that if you were to basically get some steady work somewhat above minimum wage, but not by much, and you were frugal, even with those arguably strict conditions, you could still basically accumulate a nest egg. And that, I think, is a rather impressive claim, if it's actually true.
Yeah. Yeah, that's definitely true. And also in that article, and I wanted to mention this too, because I think something in that article that she wrote was actually quite profound in my opinion. So I'm going to read that quick quote here, and then we'll talk about it. But and this is from Kyle's article, not Rayo. This is not Rayo speaking. Quote, yet again, $2 back then became apparent approximately $11.75 in 2017. So Rayo isn't insisting that you earn $40,000 a year, around $20 an hour, because he's presuming that you're not spending most of it even on the cost of living. In other words, Rayo's suggestion for achieving financial independence relies more upon living close to the bone rather than hustling, as it were. His recommendation that an individual could become vonuer by initially saving $10,575 as a nest egg to live on for 2 years removes the age-old excuse that freedom or liberty is unachievable because it costs too many ferns to accomplish it. End quote. I think that's pretty profound. I know at least a couple folks, one pretty personally, who lives on $500 a month, which would be, you know, $6,000 a year. That's pretty incredible.
Yeah.
So I that was very like it, again, it's like, well, you know, I just need to make more money, then I can become free. I don't know about that, but I don't know.
Well, I'm definitely glad you like that particular portion of the article, where I was trying to interpret what Ray was getting at. So I was both kind of doing the mathematics and also trying to kind of like logically infer what he was kind of getting at. And yeah, that was the conclusion I kind of came to, is, you know, by the time he kind of settled all out, basically he's saying pretty much the equivalent of being just above the current poverty threshold for purposes of the federal income tax, basically that $10,500 or so, you know, so you're just above it, but not by much. That, yeah, if you live close to the bone and all that, that's kind of the idea here. So like I mentioned a moment ago, the idea, the servile society, just in transitory passing again, the American dream of living in the 3-bedroom, 2.5-bath with the white picket fence, that's mortgaged for 30 years, and a crappy minivan with, you know, two brats or whatever, is not really feasible, and there's no way in hell you're going to become financially independent, even if you didn't have the children in the first place, because of those other upfront expenses and such. So if you were to cut a lot of that stuff out, then yeah, being able to live on $10,575 a year actually starts to become at least somewhat plausible. And well, I'm not even talking about the van nomadism yet, you know, living in the car or whatever. Not even talking about that yet. Just even something like a crappy one studio apartment, for example, depending on the rent and depending on the location, could even be probable, at least in some ways. But again, it's not so much the type of Vanu shelter. The point here, and as for the purpose of this episode, the point here is the exporting the labor. What are you actually able to rake in terms of, yes, profit, for those of you who may have been socialists in a past life. Yes, I am talking about profit here, because this is your livelihood. What are you going to survive on? I mean, unless you're a bunch of hunter-gatherers, or you're some sort of like Neolithic subsistence farmer like many people in the third world are, you're going to need money to survive. So the question is, how are you going to do that and remain and you know, become as invulnerable to coercion as possible? Because, Shane, there is such a thing as bribery and corruption. And a lot of people do a lot of unethical and sometimes even illegal stuff because the money was too good to pass up, as I've heard some excuses given in years not too long far gone by.
Yes, yes. And you mentioned the poverty threshold there, and like $10,500 or whatever. Now obviously I don't I'm sure Rayo didn't pay income taxes or any he avoided as many taxes as he possibly could. But one thing I will mention here in regards to invulnerability to coercion, Kyle, I think this might be something we need to discuss in a future episode, but actually kind of dealing with the taxes part of it. I think that might be important, because if you're making under that poverty threshold, you aren't even required to file, as far as I understand it. So maybe that's something we should discuss in more depth later on. But as for right now,
agreed.
I think that's probably sufficient. But let's move forward to more that Rayo had to say. Quote, have savings before moving. During your first year or two in a wilderness or Vanu environment, expect to be occupied developing shelter and learning Vanu living skills. You will have little time for money earning, even if opportunities are at hand, end quote. And let me see here. I'll make sure this next – I'll read this next quote here too, because it goes right along with that previous one. Quote, earn money by exporting labor at first. Don't expect to earn money immediately gathering herbs or dredging gold if you have time left from development. What opportunities are there, maybe for wilderness income, require considerable skills to pay off. Scrounging for jobs in a small town is a bad scene. Get jobs in cities if that is what you have done, preferably temporary employment, which fits your living patterns. If you have a free mate or children, let them remain at your Vanu home while you commute weekly or seasonally. Why subject them to bludge, smog, and chance of nuclear incineration, end quote. So both of those things kind of tie in again, and tie in again to, have that money beforehand, right? Have that nest egg before moving, because you aren't going to have a lot of time to go make that money, even if you can. Because, just consider, just as like a thought experiment, obviously we'll get into more solutions that don't require, that aren't this radically kind of than Rayo took them to. But just consider this. You're Rayo back in, the 60s. And, Van Nomadism is, radical enough for some folks. But he takes it even further. And he says, screw the van. Let me just, put up a plastic polyethylene A10 here, put a line in between it, and just spend all my time trying to develop structural improvements to where we can, be sheltered from rain, and we can stay warm, and we can get our little foam hut or whatever it is. Just imagine how much time that took him and how many times they tried and failed. I remember at least a couple times in the book, he was like, yeah, we had to completely replace our gear because, what we were using was terrible equipment. So it'll take a lot of time to figure out some of these things. And, we're limited on our time, guys, unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, I don't know. Kind of depends upon your perspective there, but
you just made an argument for time preference again, didn't you?
I think so. But you're not going to have when you're trying to develop these skills, even something like, wilderness Vanu. Well, I guess that is wilderness Vanu. But imagine you just have a backpack and knife and 2 weeks of food or something like that. And you have to go figure out everything else out in the woods. You're not going to be worried about going and finding a job. You're going to be worried about surviving in the wilderness. So you aren't going to have a lot of time to find a job. So that nest egg is definitely important. And I'm really, really happy. Some of these quotes may seem redundant and kind of we're kind of stuck on this topic, but it's important. It really is important. We want to hammer home the fact that it kind of seems necessary that you have at least some nest egg on hand before. Right, Kyle?
Yes. And also to kind of make another passing reference to a season one episode, actually the Mean Time to Harassment, actually specifically that episode, you just mentioned the backpack a moment ago. Well, that's technically B-level Vanumi, isn't it? In terms of capability. And let me make this concrete, because this is, season two, we're getting into practical stuff now. Let me put it this way. There have been, and this is coming more from my environmentalist side, there have been people who have done something called through hiking some of the major trails in this country, whether it be the Appalachian Trail, more in, Appalachia, which is technically closer to the East Coast, or it'd be the Continental Divide Trail, or it would be the Pacific Crest Trail. Those tend to be the big three. and people through hike like from end to end, at least one of those, sometimes two, and very few people actually do all three. Or at the very least, they'll use a pack animal for the Pacific Crest Trail. Or was that the Continental Divide? I can't quite tell. I don't know if they allow that on the AT, though. But at the very least, I would just say this. If people really want to kind of get an idea for developing wilderness, survival skills of one kind or another, whether it be VANU or not, you know, go backpacking, even if it's just for a weekend, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, for example.
And yes, I actually have a cousin and his wife did that as their honeymoon. And that seems like a really great, to kind of see if you aren't quite sure if that's for you. I mean, yeah, obviously don't just I don't know if I want to do wilderness VANU, but I'm just going to quit my job and move out of my apartment and we're just going to go do this. No, I mean, there are ways to kind of test out whether these things are for you or not, because again, VANU, there's a lot of strategies involved with it. But go ahead, Kyle. Sorry.
Refer back to something from a different season one episode, which I can't recall right offhand. VANU is not an all or nothing thing. There is a spectrum here. And so, as such, given that there is a spectrum, and even I said in the MTH episode, I do think it's important for people to kind of, develop that A-level competency first and then to B and C and D and so forth, kind of do this incrementally, take one step at a time type of thing. And so regarding backpacking, which would be more B-level VANU-y, I would just, I'd like to offer this idea. If you were really serious about backpacking for whatever your reasons are, and you decided to try and through hike one of those three major trails I mentioned, consider this. There have been successful through hikers who have mentioned and who are on the record. I haven't really written about this yet. Maybe someday I will. But they've mentioned about how they needed nest eggs. That's why this is relevant for this episode. They actually had to have nest eggs and it wasn't like, hundreds of thousands of dollars. That's ridiculous. You can pretty much through hike the AT depending on how extravagant you want to get with your food and some of your gear, anywhere between, I think one guy did it on $7,000 and I think a lot of people do it on 15 grand. Wow. But that was it takes the better part of a year to, okay, I'm a little bit more familiar with the Appalachian Trail. It takes the better part of a year to actually through hike the AT and do it successfully and do it right. So you're talking 9-10 months of the year, maybe give or take a month, depending how fast you hike, and so forth. But yeah, those guys quit their jobs or they're on sabbatical for a year or whatever their employment situation is, presumably. And so, yeah, they are living off their savings. So when they get there, not to go on too long about this, but this is a concrete type of example. So when they get their drop shipments periodically at different points on the trail, every 10, 15, 20 miles or whatever the range is, they'll adjust the distances based on terrain and how quickly they're moving and such. When they get their drop shipments and all that, how are those drop shipments of food and supplies being paid for? Oh, wait, that's right. They're nest eggs. Right, because these aren't government subsidies. These are private people using their privately accumulated nest eggs to basically fund their through hikes. That's how this works, ladies and gentlemen. So even for something like that, which is on the public record, it's just not very well known. It's kind of obscure. Financial independence does have actual practical uses and enables and opens the door for you to do certain things like through hiking major, trails in these United States.
Yes. Yes. I'm really happy you brought that up because, I guess that'd be a very, very good first test. I mean, that would also kind of go along with other things we talked about. Can you actually build up that nest egg? Hopefully you can. And then also, can you successfully, hike the trail? And did you enjoy it? Were you happy? How was your mental state? Because if you got halfway through it and you said, this is terrible, I don't like this, I just want to go back to air conditioning or whatever it is, then that's probably not the route for you, right?
And not only that, but, if you hate being a backpacker, are you really going to enjoy living in a van full time, which is sea level VANU-y? I mean, honestly, Shane, like I said in the MTH episode, I think there's a spectrum here. And, you know, I'm not saying everybody needs to be homeless, which would be the A-level competency or vonomy. But I am saying, like, I don't know, man. It's in some ways it's kind of like mathematics. Like, can you really expect somebody who can't add 2 + 2 to do algebra? Maybe not necessarily quadratic equations, but I mean, without getting too technical here, it's just like, can you, okay, let me put it this way. Can you really expect someone who can barely walk and kind of needs like a crutch or a cane or something to run a marathon?
Yeah.
You know, I think there is such a thing as like putting one foot in front of the other and such. So yeah, if you have people who aren't even willing to be backpackers, but they're kind of like loosely entertaining the idea of living in a van because they've seen it popularized on YouTube by the so-called minimalists and some other people who have just really select packaging and marketing, which is starting to approach that of like consumerism. I don't know, man. I think there's a lot of glitz and glamour and maybe not sensationalism, but a glossing over the realities, good, bad, and indifferent, of these different living situations and such, lifestyle changes, to where people maybe may have some, you know, unrealistic expectations, which are a little high, and sometimes even reflected in their romantic relationships, which itself is going to have to be a different episode involving freemates, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and I guess with keep in mind, if you're one of those folks who watches those minimalist van nomadists or whatever on YouTube, keep in mind that I would say probably 99.9% of them probably aren't doing this with the goal of achieving Vanu. So their concerns that they have to overcome are probably going to be a little more a little simpler than the ones that you might have to deal with, such as the bludgies and things, bludgies and registration, all of that stuff. So I mean, yeah, I would Kyle, I would recommend people, you know, to get an idea of what that kind of consists of. Maybe Alex Ansari's channel, YouTube channel. And then, you know, hell, even just go ahead and check out some of those people on YouTube to get an idea. And if their problems are, you know, if you think those are kind of difficult, then maybe that isn't for you. Maybe it is. Maybe you can, you know, learn more about it. And, you know, it's a lifestyle change. So if you kind of work towards that, you can possibly get to it. but yeah.
Well, yeah, and just to kind of elaborate just a little bit on Alex Ansari, I think what's kind of unique about his experience is that he gives it to you raw, and there's no sugarcoating, there's no glitz and glamour. He's just saying, hey, here's some stuff that happened today, you know, the good, the bad, and the downright ugly. And, you know, here's just some stuff that happened. Here's some things you may want to consider. Here's how I learned from my mistakes. Here's also some good things that happened, and so forth. I think Alex, who is a colleague of mine, another one in the alternative media or free media, right? That was that hashtag he started, which I do agree with for other reasons, because of the alt-right co-opting the alternative media and such. Different topic for another time. That, yeah, man, I think Alex Ansari's approach to really showing people, if you're really going to kind of emulate, you know, Henry Thoreau in some sense in this early 21st century America, you know, what does that actually realistically look like? And I think Alex does a good job really kind of documenting it and kind of really open sourcing it and making it available for anyone on the internet, really, to kind of look at his material who are willing to take the time and watch the materials he has at, you know, alexansary.tv and whatever else, to basically kind of like, oh, You know, living in, you know, an RV, it may not be all that it's chalked up to be, at least in some sense for some people, right? Because value is subjective.
Yep.
Some people will be more than happy to do it. Others won't. And all I'm saying is, you know, if you ain't happy, you know, being a backpacker, you know, are you really going to make it living in a van full time or even part time even? But yeah, the point, though, is that regarding financial independence and the nest eggs and all that, you know, I mean, there are those upfront costs if you're living in a van. There, you know, you were mentioning like some of the legal interstices, and you know, if you're through hiking, you know, one of those major trails, you know, how are you going to pay for the drop shipments of the supplies you need to replenish, like food and you know, toilet paper and whatever else? I mean, that costs money too. Hell, even if you were doing A-level vonomy and you were just simply homeless, maybe you need at least a little bit of money to, at least for some things, maybe not a lot, but maybe, I don't know, $20 or something. I don't know.
All right, Kyle, on this next quote, again, starts out, you kind of what we've been hammering home this in, like this entire portion of this this episode so far. But, you know, I think, again, reiteration may get annoying, but there's a point here. Quote, don't change vocations until you achieve a VANU home. If you can clear $2 or more per hour in your present and non-VANU job, you will probably achieve VANU quickest by staying with it until you have enough capital to cut loose for 2 years. Don't spend time getting into a slightly better non-VANU occupation still dependent on that society if you expect to live most of your life out of that society. A do-at-home vocation such as freelance writing or mail order selling is best developed after you have a VANU home, end quote. So, again, you know, get that nest egg going. That's kind of what he's mentioning there. You know, for until you can cut loose for 2 years. And then also, I mean, if you're, and this is actually kind of the new aspect to it, right, Kyle? So you're making that $1,175 an hour, and you're only going to do it for 2 years. You're only going to do it for 2 years. But yeah, I mean, but you're like, oh, if I get, if I can get like a $15 per hour job, I could do this like in less time. I think he's kind of saying, don't waste your time. Just, you know, get through those 2 years, get that nest egg, and just get out.
Yeah. That's, I mean, that, I mean, yeah, once again, there's you know, going by time preference, right, for those of you who are familiar with the Austrian School of Economics and their subjective theory of value and all that. But yes, there is a time preference issue going on here, right? So kind of, do you hold out, the question being, do you hold out for a slightly better, you know, per hour rate of whatever the hell, but then you're getting more, as Rhea put it, psychologically invested in the servile society and all of that, or do you take the somewhat lesser rate, but then save, be frugal, don't spend a lot, and then just cut loose as soon as you get enough of that that nest egg where you haven't had to psychologically invest in getting a higher rate, for instance. So again, it's a trade-off. One more time, that's that I think Rayo is kind of getting at
yes.
here.
And one other point here, which I think could set. And there are some, you know, some podcasters and some, I know there's some entrepreneurs that listen to this podcast. You know, in the last sentence, quote, a do-at-home vocation such as freelance writing or mail order selling is best developed after you have a VANU home. Well, if you already kind of have that set up before you have your VANU home, then you're already ahead of the game. So there you go. There you go.
Yeah.
So that's definitely a plus for those that have those things now. And if you don't, I mean, you know, why not kind of look at some side businesses if you have a full-time job, you know, get that side hustle going. Maybe you can, you know, kind of take over your full-time job and you can do what you enjoy to get to your nest egg that for that 2 years of sustainment. And you don't have to actually work your servile society job, and maybe you can carry that over to your VANU life as well. I mean, who knows, right? Just depends upon what you are doing. Anything else there, Kyle, or are you ready to move on to more of the similar, but Rayo's kind of, you know, extrapolating these things out, but anything else there?
Sure, just one thing kind of briefly. I would just simply say this for the listeners. Keep in mind that the idea of discipline in terms of not spending a lot and earning more, if you will, kind of like, you raise your income and you lower your expenses, kind of like a seesaw, right? Where in a sense, it's kind of like a zero-sum game where you want to live well beneath your means. That basically the notion of like fiscal discipline is actually very important here, because if you're just going to be a spendthrift and spend every dime you have, or worse, go into debt, then this is not for you, and you're not even close to practicing VANU. Heck, you're not even being frugal. And so there's kind of like a baseline here with financial independence and its relationship to VANU, in that there's already certain assumptions being made that you are fiscally responsible, that you are already living beneath your means. And then all Rayo is saying here is basically just up the ante, become even more frugal so that you can kind of achieve this kind of status of being financially independent, which is like frugality and some other things thrown in there, like on steroids, but in a good way, and ultimately making yourself the newer. And so that's just something kind of to keep in mind, that there's a certain baseline of discipline that's actually required here in order to pull this off and make it work. Otherwise, you're just going to be a spendthrift and you're never going to get anywhere in terms of achieving financial independence.
Yes, and one final thing on that. I mean, libertarians, anarchists, folks like that are always accused of being just radical. And I know I like to prove them wrong. Oh, you think that's radical? Let's see how far we can take it. I know there are a lot of others like you out there. So why not see how radical you can take your financial independence, and your intensive saving? Maybe you can get to 95%, maybe 96%, 97%. I mean, who knows, right? Always got whatever. Obviously, that may be unrealistic, but anyways, just a little something there. This next quote, quote, tactics for saving, make a crash program of it. Save a high proportion of income for a short time. Take savings off the top, a certain percentage of income, and live on what is left. Concentrate on big or continuing expenses, usually shelter, transportation, and food, but also be careful of that small luxuries. Also be careful that small luxuries don't get big. Double up with others to save rent. Drive little. Make part of your monetary savings untouchable until required capital is accumulated. Don't rationalize that such and such item is really preparation for VANU unless you already have much experience and your intended lifestyle and know exactly what equipment and supplies you will need. Start outfitting at a local dump, discarded blankets, clothes, utensils, then try Salvation Army stores, etc. You can gradually replace with better equipment after you are VANU, as you learn what you really need. End quote. Now, Kyle, this is this is essentially what I've been doing with in my pursuance of frugality or financially independent early retirement. I'm starting with 50%. If I can do 50%, that's 40% better than what I used to do, right? So this isn't something where it's like, okay, you want to be VANU, you have to do this right now. You have to get to this point. You've got to start. You got to get to 80% of your income, or you're not.
No, that's dumb.
It is dumb. It's not how it is. So I'm starting with 50%, and as I see those savings start accumulating, I might say, I want more of this in my safe. I want more of this. In my safe. Like so I'm just gonna start saving more. I'm gonna cut down on expenses even further, and get to a higher savings point. So I think that's one thing too. And then also in regards to, and I'll speak to this here in a moment, but make part of your monetary savings untouchable. Well, that's kind of what I'm doing with, investing in cryptocurrencies, although, again, I'll get into that here more in a moment, but it's not cash, like in my safe where I can spend it. It's off somewhere where it would need, I would actually have to, it's not something I can just like go in, put in the code and then take out the cash and go spend it. It's a little more of a process than that. So it takes a little bit of work, and oftentimes when I get off of work and then I'm starting more work, on podcasts and things, I really don't feel like doing that. So whether it's untouchable or just hard to get to, I think either of those is good. But I know you probably got something to say on the scavenging, or maybe the dumpster diving that he's kind of referring to here.
Well, yeah, there's different elements. So yeah, I'll start with that. So obviously, I wrote an article a while back which was called "A Primer on Freeganism." And there was also some background articles too that went into more detail. But the long and short of it is that, yeah, there's a ideology of activism, so-called, which is about essentially, ironically, because they're actually socialists, that are actually all about salvaging abandoned property. And there are various ways that they do this, but the particular type of technique that the Freegans are most well recognized for in terms of salvaging that abandoned property is dumpster diving. And sometimes it's dumpster diving for clothes or furniture or non-edibles of one kind or another that can be refurbished or otherwise repurposed. But the portion of that which is, well, they're most notable for is, of course, dumpster diving for food. Now, I think what Rhea was kind of getting at here was more, like he said, discarded blankets, clothes, utensils. And so, yeah, he's basically, dumpster diving for non-edibles, right? He's talking more like basic equipment you need for probably B-level Vanumi, maybe a little bit of A-level Vanumi, too. But basically, discarded blankets, clothes, utensils. Yeah, I mean, there's nothing involving a van there, which would be sea level. So that's kind of interesting in terms of like trying to cut down on costs And by the way, the Freegans kind of do the same thing too, because they mention, like, I remember one of the Freegans a while back who basically mentioned that he hasn't been in a grocery store in years because he's able to adequately feed himself strictly off of the food that he's been able to dumpster dive. So again, without getting into dumpster diving specifically, the connection here is if you were able to dump, for example, dumpster dive for your food, and you, let's presume you never get sick because you did it right, and there are ways of learning how to do that and so forth. If you were able to dumpster dive and acquire a sufficient amount of that, well, salvaged abandoned property and so forth, then yeah, your costs could be cut, and the saving, and this is the important part, and this is the relevance of this to this episode, the savings that you have now well, it's an opportunity cost issue, isn't it, Shane? The money that would have been spent on the grocery bill can now be reallocated towards something else, like, oh, I don't know, growing that nest egg, for example, and you were able to do that because you went dumpster diving. So that's one. That's another way that, see, multiple, it's the financial independence is the gift that keeps on giving.
Yes, and I want to jump in here for just a moment. And I mentioned, but maybe I think I mentioned on this podcast before that I live in a college town. There are two colleges where I live, and once the students move out, I mean, you know the time preference issue there, Kyle. It's crazy. They have they move out of their apartment after that semester or after the year, and then they throw out all of their like brand new stuff.
Yeah, their time pre
that mommy and daddy bought them.
Yeah,
probably.
Their time preference is incredibly short. But, yeah.
But there's you kind of drive through the campus there, it's kind of a thing. So like, don't think like if you're like going through like stuff people threw away that you're a piece of trash. All sorts of people do it. I mean, like this isn't like, you know, dumpster diving for like a ripped T-shirt. This is like, one thing you might find that we've got is a brand new beer pong table. Probably cost a couple $100, but yeah, we got that for free. And you can get some like brand new furniture. You can get some very good electronics. Even if you don't decide to keep them, that might be towards your financial independence too. You can resell it. On Craigslist,
might need
things.
To fix it and resell depending on the condition. But yes, your point is well taken. Because there are people take a parallel, different approach to dumpster diving, where instead of the Freegans, who for whatever reason hate money or private property, or whatever, even though they actually are salvaging a private property, which is ironic, topic for another time. There are people who dumpster dive for profit and either clean up or refurbish or fix whatever they find in the dumpster and then resell it, for example, on Craigslist or other websites, and then they turn a profit, which actually is not necessarily a bad way of freelancing, isn't it? That kind of form of reselling, Shane.
Yes, and one other thing there. I'd recommend for those of you that have like a truck or something, you know, watch that free Craigslist portion. You can find a lot of very interesting building materials and things, rock or whatever. And if you have a connection, some business that needs that material, you can get it for free and then sell it. So yeah, I mean there are ways to turn the dump, like, so you could use dumpster diving for building up that nest egg, or you can use dumpster diving as kind of like your side business, where you scour the free Craigslist thing and find stuff that you say, okay, I know a few people that'll buy this, you know, I'll go pick that up today and go sell it. so there are a lot of it's. As with Vanu, Kyle, I mean, the options for like financial independence and, you know, side businesses and like, you know, building up that nest egg are honestly endless. The only limitations are your imagination and your
creativity. Exactly. And before we get on to the next quote, one thing I just thought of that absolutely needs to be mentioned is not everybody necessarily needs to like read Ludwig von Mises's Human Action. However, I would say one idea from that book is actually rather quite relevant here, considering all the mathematics that are being mentioned, which is quite simply this. The only known solution to the economic calculation problem is, of course, prices. And socialists were never able to solve the economic calculation problem because, for whatever reason, they don't like prices. And the closest thing they had to an answer, which was not an answer, was, of course, central planning. Having said that, the relevance here is that if you want to achieve financial independence, there is absolutely no way on God's green earth that you're going to do that through central planning of any kind. the only way you're going to basically achieve financial independence is by, well, economic calculation through prices as a barometer for basically determining, yes, subjective value, actually. So that's kind of rather significant. Now, I know Mises really liked double entry bookkeeping. I'm not exactly certain whether everybody who's an entrepreneur needs to learn double entry bookkeeping. I would say this, though, you need to be able to perform your own economic calculations so you turn a profit instead of going the other way around where you're actually paying people at a loss to do things for you, which of course is basically really kind of counterproductive. I mean, at that way, you would actually preserve more of your wealth just giving stuff away for free at that point. So turning a profit is your livelihood. That is how you survive. And so, yes, just as kind of a little bit of a side note. So, yes, all this socialist rhetoric about one thing or another is really just kind of funny because they're basically spitting in the face of financial independence is what they're really doing because they're propping up the warfare welfare state.
Yes, yes. And then also one other thing here, like I could do the market research here where I live and I could say, okay, here for some odd reason, people like, baby clothes and they like used records or they like this or that. In your area, that might be completely different. They might prefer, hammers and nails. They might prefer, well, not nails, but that's not really something that she could resell at any worthwhile profit. But, they like tools. They like, used pickup trucks. They like X, Y, or Z. So, as a financial independence route, Kyle, I mentioned to you that I was reading, Adam Cash's book, Guerrilla Capitalism, how to practice free enterprise in an unfree economy. And, the whole, finding stuff on Craigslist, kind of seems pretty appealing now. So, it seems pretty profitable too and a very good side business. So if that's something that may interest you, do the market research in the town that you live in and, find out what people want. Maybe it's used baby clothes. Who knows what it is? You'll have to figure that out yourself. But there are ways. There certainly are ways, a very plentiful amount of ways that you can, build up your nest egg in that manner.
Right. And before we get on to the next quote, one thing I just thought of, which is actually relevant to what you read a little bit ago, is that, in some ways you could compare the path towards financial independence as being arguably akin to achieving good physical fitness, in that generally speaking, all other factors being equal, in order to achieve good physical fitness, you have to do two things and do two things consistently and, yes, in a disciplined manner. And those two things are that you have to eat less and exercise more. There's a lot of nuance that can play into that, but I'm talking in generalities here for purposes of time and relevance because we're trying to stick to issues of finances here. So eat less and exercise more. By analogy or by comparison, you need to, if you want to achieve financial independence, that good physical fitness, if you will, you have to be able to spend less and earn more. And so when Rayo was mentioning here about doubling up with others to save rent, driving little, and yet like earning more money and such, he's basically kind of, if you want to conceptualize it kind of like a seesaw in a manner of speaking. You have to basically do one more of one and less of the other. And the problem, Shane, with the servile society, to kind of compare, these two types of things, I'm sorry, but good Americans eat too much. And not only just eat too much, without getting too much into specifics, they also, the quality of food is crap too, generally speaking. And it's not just the GMOs. There's a lot more to it than that, like the corn subsidies and all the 20,000 million different effects of that. But yeah, good Americans eat too much and they don't exercise enough because they're, sedentary, very sedentary lifestyles more often than not. And by a similar token, for purposes of this episode, good Americans within the servile society spend too much and they earn too little. And so really what kind of Rayo is saying here is, well, if you want to be free, at least in some sense, kind of do the complete opposite. Spend less and earn more. Now, to be fair, Shane, I would also say this. It's simple to say that. It sure ain't easy to spend less and earn more.
No, it's definitely not. And unfortunately, you know what? I'll admit, you know, I'm a human being. I make mistakes, guys. You might be surprised.
Twice as much.
But yeah, with my frugality, you know, that I've been doing for the past couple of months, you know, I've slipped up on the food thing. You know, it's just far too convenient. You know, I do a lot. I do a lot of work when I'm home, and you know, I just haven't gotten around to until today, you know, getting around to the grocery store to, you know, like, reinvigorate my, you know, my frugal food diet. So I mean, yeah, I slipped up and a little bit due to laziness, but regardless, it is a lifestyle change, and it takes constant. It's like a bad habit. You may kick it for a month, but at some point, I mean, you may kind of, you know, get back into it just a little bit and then realize, you know, this isn't what I wanted to do. I want to do this and, you know, improve my life. So, I mean, this isn't going to be any, it's like, you know, lifestyle changes are not easy. You know what's easy, though? Going and pushing a button in a voting booth. You know what? That does absolutely nothing. These things that actually, you know, actually can improve your, I mean, financial independence, even if you do nothing else, which obviously we hope you do more than that and you continue listening to the podcast. But even if you only, like, you know, pursue financial independence and, you know, a job becomes optional, the freedom that you will find from that, your family members, your friends are going to be in awe. Job becomes optional. What? Are you kidding me? You don't have to work 40, 50, 60 hours a week to, you know, live? Are you serious? I mean, that the freedom that could bring you alone, I think is pretty incredible. And for this just being the starting point of Vanu, especially this season two, I really, you're going to want to keep listening.
Yeah. And again, I can't emphasize this enough, you know, discipline in a lot of ways can coincide with freedom, whereas our purpose is here, Vanu, right? Because, and we'll get into this later in season two, but like the entire notion of security culture itself, and a little bit on a more deeper level, actually does require at least some degree of discipline in order to do it well, to do it consistently and so forth, in the sense of like where it's effective and such. And so same thing here. You know, whether it be with terms of physical fitness, you know, at least losing fat, if not also losing fat and building muscle, which is what actual bodybuilding is, you know, regarding the fiscal bodybuilding, in a manner of speaking, right? You have to spend less and earn more. And then the question kind of comes down to, okay, how do you do that? And I think import-export is one way of conceptualizing how to do that effectively.
Yes. Yes, it definitely is. It definitely is. But we'll leave it there for this episode of the Vanu Podcast. There's certainly enough there to digest and consider for this week. Next week, you'll hear part two of this episode, which will include Rayo's recommendations on saving money, a brief discussion on the utility of cryptocurrencies and assisting Vanuans in a multitude of ways, and just a brief discussion, because that will be some season three material, primer on Austrian economics and why socialism can never work, as well as our overall conclusion for the financial independence portion. And if you're confused about the Austrian economics part, it does relate to financial independence, and you just heard, you know, a little bit of that in this one, but that will kind of continue as we get into the part two of this episode. So we certainly hope you enjoyed the first episode of season two. Make sure to check out the website, vanupodcast.com, and you'll find the article that goes along with this episode, as well as a collection of posts discussing the history of attempts at founding new libertarian countries. And I'd highly recommend you check those out. Very interesting stuff that will certainly be covered in a future episode. And while you're there, make sure to pick up, if you haven't already, pick up Rayo's book, Vanu, The Search for Personal Freedom. It's right there. It's the second tab. You can't miss it. So, thanks so much, guys. We'll talk to you next week.